the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start off today with the annual highway cost allocation presentation. First, a briefing from our own Mazen Malik.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. The highway cost allocation presentation is the biennial show that everybody waits eagerly for. And it is fitting that it comes in the first morning after day savings time kicks in, just to wake everybody up and gives us that energy. And just a quick brief idea. As you know, the highway cost allocation is a response to requirements in the constitutional Title 9, basically saying that contribution of heavy vehicles to light vehicles need to be proportional. Through this process in law, ask DAS or the State Economist Office to look into this issue. They put together a study group, and the study group also consults with an economic consultant who looks into these issues, find all the proportions, what needs to be done, and they come and report to you at the end of this effort. And this is what we would have today, is the state economist, also our consultant, and a representative from the study review team to come to you, Mr. Campbell, Carl Beth, and then Mark from the our state economist. So I'll ask them to come and brief you.
All right, come on in. Quite a closing. That's a drama.
Yeah.
Is it just a drama?
You can do the whole presentation.
Carl will be up in a second. Yeah, no, he does. He's going to do most of it. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McMullen. I'm the Oregon State Economist, here, as Mazen told you, to fulfill our constitutional requirement to present the results of the biennial highway cost allocation study. My apologies to Senator Riley, who's already sat through this in a related transportation committee. But the highway cost allocation study, we can go pretty quick because we've got it fairly well streamlined by now. Oregon really is the state of the art in terms of highway cost allocation. This will be our 20th study, and we have ironed out quite a few of the wrinkles in it. Credit goes to support staff. We get a tremendous job from Echo Northwest, the consultant that we contract out with, as well as a tremendous amount of help from ODOT staff and the staff for a lot of our stakeholders who are on our study review team. And the study review team, that is really what we bring to the process. As chair of the study review team, the key really there is to iron out a lot of the technical details. It's a very highly technical study in order to come up with the final numbers. And while the details are technical, they do have really large dollar associated with them, and so they aren't trivial, albeit technical. However, the study review team that's made up of a lot of stakeholders who care, the counties, the cars, the trucks, the bikes, and the like, and we bring in some academics as well. They would rather wrestle out these technical details in our committee setting rather than bringing them to policymakers' offices, because when they do get their limited time in front of you all, they have larger fish to fry. And so that's really what the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis brings to the table, is just to try to apply the same sort of transparent, objective process that we do for most of our forecasts, and to make it open to all the subject matter experts that, that you see listed here. So the first person to chime in is going to be Craig Campbell, who is a longtime member of our study review teams, to tell you a little bit how it works.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell from AAA, and as has been said, we've done a number of these studies. Oregon does it as a part of our constitutional requirement, and really it's so that when you are making decisions about how to apply taxes in a transportation funding package, at least as far as a legislative application is concerned, you know really how to apply between light vehicles and heavy vehicles, cars and trucks. It's a very complicated study, and the good news is you want these studies to be as boring as possible, because when they come before you, you don't want to have a lot of outstanding issues that you as the legislature needs to try to resolve. We've gotten very good at these very complicated studies. It's called a cost allocation study, but the reality is it's an expenditure allocation study, because what it does is it takes those expenditures that we make out of the highway fund, and we also deal with revenues from the federal and local level, and identifies how those monies are being expended on the road and who's responsible for those expenditures, so that we can allocate between cars and trucks, which is, of course, very important when you're determining how much money you need to raise to do various projects. Mr. Malik has the unenviable position of, once you decided how much money to raise from cars, he needs to use this process to determine how much weight mile tax or truck registration fees, etc., have to be raised in order to make sure trucks are paying their fair share as well. It's a rather long process. It goes over a 2-year period. This time around, we were rather fortunate. We usually do a lot of what we call white papers, where we have identified specific issues that really we need to delve in more in depth. Sometimes that will deal with things like studded tire damage, or how to allocate a particular set of factors. For instance, a few years ago, we had an influx of money for bridge construction, and that created an interesting wave that we had to try to figure out how to allocate. But the nice thing is that the people that we have around that table are very, very experienced. In fact, they're the most experienced in the United States in doing these. And as a result, the result you get before you, while boring, you can be confident that it was done correctly. It's difficult to be the color commentary on a cost allocation study, but I've tried my best. And yes, with that, I'll now turn it over to to the consultant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carl Batten. I'm with Echo Northwest in Portland, Oregon. And this is, we've been working on highway cost allocation studies in Oregon since the 2001 study. This is Oregon's 20th study. The first was in 1937. It was conducted by Condi McCullough, the engineer who designed all the bridges on the Oregon coast. And since 1999, the Constitution has required that a study be performed every 2 years for every session, and that the rates be adjusted if necessary. The exact words from the Constitution are here on the slide. I won't read them out for you, but they can be paraphrased by the question that we have to answer, and that question is, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of cost? And the way we go about answering that question is by constructing what we call equity ratios. The equity ratio is the ratio of the share of revenue paid by a particular weight class of vehicles to its share of cost. An equity ratio of 1.0 means that the share of cost is equal to the share of revenue, and they are paying their fair share. If the equity ratio is more than one, it means they're paying more than their fair share, and if it's less than one, it means they're paying less. Oregon's approach to highway cost allocation is based on the federal approach, which was last applied in 1997. Oregon's has continued to evolve since then. In Oregon, the cost to allocate are the budgeted expenditures for the upcoming biennium, so it's a forecast of what's actually going to be spent. We do count expenditures of federal funds by the state, because they're interchangeable with the state user fee revenues. and if they were spent on different types of projects, it could change the equity ratio if we didn't treat them all the same. We count the expenditures of local governments of state user fee revenues, and we count the expenditures by local governments of federal revenues and some of their own source revenues. The local government own source revenues that we exclude are those that are dedicated to particular purposes and can't be interchanged with the state user fees. This slide shows the composition of Oregon's highway expenditures, the expected composition for the upcoming biennium based on the ODOT's agency request budget. And the height of each of those blue bars is how much is expected to be spent, including federal and local money. And the red label on the top of each bar shows what percent of that blue bar is federal money. So you can see there's a big difference between categories and what share of it is federal money and what share is state money. In Oregon's approach, equity ratios are calculated for the upcoming biennium, which means that in addition to having the forecasted expenditures, we have to forecast miles of travel, and we have to forecast revenues. The miles of travel forecast is prepared by ODOT, by Dan Porter, and it's the same mileage forecast that is used to produce the agency request budget. In that forecast, we're expecting 35.7 billion miles per year by light vehicles and 3.1 billion miles per year by heavy vehicles. So about 96% of the miles are by light vehicles. And the revenue forecast we use assumes current law instruments and rates. So one thing to point out is that if there is a package this session, that package might change the expenditures from what they are in the agency request budget, and it might also change some of the revenue instruments and rates, in which case, as Craig pointed out, MOSM will be applying the highway cost allocation model to keep things in balance under the package. This slide shows the trend in vehicle miles traveled from 2002 to 2016. The gray area is the recession. You can see that miles traveled dropped during the recession and came back as the recession ended, but didn't really pick up again until about 2014. And since 2014, miles traveled has increased substantially. One of the things you don't see in this graph is that the VMT per capita per person in Oregon was declining since about 1999 until about 2014. So as the population increased, vehicle miles traveled didn't really increase in Oregon until just recently, and now travel per person is increasing at the same time that population continues to increase and employment is increasing, putting significantly more cars on the road than there were just a few years ago. Our results from the study show a equity ratio for light vehicles of 1.0076 and for heavy vehicles of 0.9865. These are well within the margin of error. We're unable to say that either of them is different from 1.00. And the reason there is a margin of error is that the expenditures, the revenues, and the miles traveled are all forecasted. And in fact, the miles traveled by light vehicles will never be measured. So as a consequence, there isn't a requirement that user fees be adjusted in the upcoming biennium unless, for example, there's a package and user fees need to be changed for some other reason, in which case equity would need to be maintained by keeping the different fees in line with each other. Chairman?
Light vehicles include electric cars and cars.
Light vehicles include all vehicles up to 10,000 pounds, so it's cars and pickup trucks and SUVs.
There's no way to have a separate category to pull them out, because obviously if they're not buying gas, for the most part, they're not representing the revenues.
Correct. Yeah, in a prior study, in a couple of prior studies, we did issue papers on how electric vehicles, for example, should be treated, and there currently isn't a good way to treat them, and the current revenue instruments don't collect revenue from them other than registration fees.
So I'm guessing if you somehow took out that those electric cars from your light vehicles category, you would have a smaller number, but they would still, that smaller number would be paying, you know, 64% of the cost.
Yes, although currently the number of electric vehicles on the road in Oregon makes very little difference. That number is growing, and in the future will be more important.
Just added to electric vehicles is high miles per gallon vehicles.
Yeah.
Same exact situation.
Yeah.
Which we are.
That's what I meant. Is right. Those two.
Right. Which we are addressing on the transportation side.
Good. We'll have that bill when.
You're not going to see that till June.
Go ahead.
That's all I have.
That also is quite a conclusion. did we want to go to the flat fee, Marston?
Yes. If you don't have any questions of this panel, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bercher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just did some quick math. If a vehicle, this is for the electric vehicle question, if an average vehicle drives 10,000 miles a year, wouldn't that be like $150, $200 in gas tax that a normal car would pay? Isn't it somewhere in there?
Let's see. My math brain's a little slow in this daylight savings time morning. But, yeah, if it's 30 cents a gallon, and if you're generous and assume 30 gallons, that's about or 30 miles per gallon, that's about a penny per mile. So $100 for 10,000 miles. If you get 20 miles to the gallon, which is closer to the fleet average, it would be about $150.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to the Oregon flat fee study. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the flat fee study is almost a corollary of this study. The statutes also ask for ODOT to examine this instrument of payment of the heavy vehicles when they don't pay on weight mile taxes. They pay on what we have as a flat fee, and those are for commodities. And the law asks us to look at these, whether they are paying their fair share or not. So every biennium, you have also this Oregon flat fee study to quickly give you that conclusion.
Okay. Welcome.
All right. Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Porter. I'm an economist for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as Mr. Malik said, I'm here to give you a report on the 2015 flat fee study. This is a statutory required study that ODOT produces every 2 years, and we do it in conjunction with the highway cost allocation study. But the question that it seeks to answer is slightly different. Well, it is different than what comes out of the HCAS. So it's not looking at equity ratios between light and heavy vehicles. It's looking at heavy specifically, and comparing carriers that pay the flat fee to carriers that pay the weight mile and seeing if they're revenue neutral. The goal is that a truck that pays, on average, a truck that pays a flat fee would pay the same as they would pay under weight mile. And there's only, what is a flat fee, in case you didn't know? A flat fee is just it's for three specific commodity classes that is kind of listed here: logs, sand and gravel, and wood chips. And you take the statutory rate and you multiply it by your declared weight in 100 pounds. And that gives you your annual amount that you would pay. You divide that by 12, you get the monthly amount. The goal is that you take a log hauler who's traveling a lot of miles on private property, who's making multiple trips a day. They have conceivably a difficult challenge to get to their taxable miles because they have to do the math on what's on public property, subtract out the private property piece. And this was put into place in 1949 specifically for log trucks so that they would make the reporting simpler for them, because then they just pay one monthly fee based on their declared weight of the vehicle or the truck, and they can drive as many miles as they want to, essentially, and make as many trips as they need to. So the rate and statute is trying to get at what's the average amount then that you would pay versus what you would pay under the weight miles so that you're revenue neutral. And who uses it? Here's our three different commodity classes that use it. And you can see that the log trucks are the majority of it. So in the 2015 study, it's about $7.9 million in revenue, and about 70% of that log hauler revenue comes from flat fee. And sand and gravel, it's much smaller piece, and that's mainly because the vehicles that will haul sand and gravel will haul other things as well that aren't eligible for flat fee. So it's probably easier just if you're going to pay weight mile for those other things, pay weight mile for the whole thing rather than just flat fee. And then there are currently no wood chip haulers who use the flat fee option. To put it in context, the combined sort of weight mile pays and the flat fee, put them together, flat fee is just a tiny percentage of the whole. It's about 3% of the total revenue that we get is from flat fee. And then on to sort of the results. This is study comparison of the last three studies. ODOT actually doesn't do it, the study itself. We hire a consultant to do it, and we've had the same consultant for several studies, and that uses the same method, so we're able to compare study to study. And the vertical bars are giving you the revenue neutral rate, so on average what the commodities should be paying in order to be revenue neutral weight mile. And then the vertical bars are the actual statutory rate. And they're really close together. It's hard to see, but it's a 759 for logs and 753 for sand and gravel. So you can see in 2011, 2013, they're very similar. There wasn't very much change. The sand and gravel were underpaying, so their statutory rate should be almost $10 per 100 pounds. And that the logs were basically revenue neutral. Now hitting on the 2015, both came down. And this is really because miles declined. Either in sand and gravel's case, miles declined faster and revenue dropped. And in logs' case, it was the revenue stayed about the same and miles declined. I think the log one can be explained partly because of harvests. We see timber harvests, the number of million board feet that went out in 2015 was less than 2013, about 10% less. So that would explain how, a truck would make less trips. And they would still pay this monthly fee, but they're taking less trips, so they're not driving as many miles. So that brings the rate down. Our Transportation Commission reviewed this study, and this would recommend that we change the statutory rates to these reflected here to bring us into revenue neutrality with weight mile. And that's the flat fee study. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, your very first photo of the log truck, that's like 50 years old, so
yeah.
You might change that. We haven't used those steaks or cheese blocks in a long time. Second thing, you made a statement that it's pretty difficult for the log haulers to document off-highway miles and stuff. As a guy that has owned more log trucks than I care to talk about, it is challenging, but we found in our company when you did have the drivers track off-highway miles and miles that the trailer is decked, it was worth it. Mm-hmm. It was really worth it. We saved a lot of money by doing that. Paperwork, yes, but it was another way to put some money towards the bottom line, and it did work.
One
One of the beauties about a citizens' legislature is you get people from
all walks of life.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. All right, committee, we're going to move on to a couple of votes in a public hearing. We'll just go through these in order. I'm going to open up a public hearing on our I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 29. Some of you remember this. It changes one date on corporate bankruptcy statutes. Do you want to give a quick refresher, Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate bill updates are tied to federal law regarding the discharge of indebtedness related to bankruptcy. The current date is in April 15th in 1995. It updates it to December 31st, 2016. There are no amendments, and it has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 29 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yep, a little bit. Remind me exactly why we're doing this.
This is the bankruptcy reconnect. And because it's not inside the federal reconnect, and in our discussions previously, we decided that maybe in the future we should just put the bloody thing with the federal reconnect. But okay. We didn't do it this time. So therefore, a good bill should pass.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That may have been the best summary of a bill we've had today. Thank you, Senator Boquist. Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Senate Bill 29 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate, and I can only ask Senator Boquist to carry that bill in the way that he just did.
He's going to use the same sentence.
Exact same sentence.
You have your floor speech already. I'm going to open up we're going to close that work session and open up a work session on Senate Bill 30 for a summary. Chris, is this you?
Yes, it is. It's another corporation tax bill. It deals with the concept of the unitary principle, which basically determines the starting point for how much federal taxable income the state can tax. And right now, just as a refresher, the unitary principle is when there are related corporations, if they effectively act as one economic unit, they all file a consolidated tax return, and then that's the starting point for determining taxation. Right now, under federal law, if, as an example, corporations A and corporations C appear to be unitary, but to make that determination, they have to look at corporation B. Right now, if that's a U.S. company, they can do that to make that unitary determination. Corporation B, however, is a foreign affiliate under current law. They can't look at that. So what Senate Bill 30 would do would be allow them to look at that foreign affiliate purely for making the determination of unitary. It doesn't change, none of that income from that foreign affiliate is brought in. And in fact, there is an amendment, a dash one, that removes some added language on page one of the bill. And the language that is removed intersects with the policy on listed jurisdiction. So with the adoption of the dash one, that intersection would be removed. And there is a minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
So okay. You want to try in English. You want the dash ones, right?
There.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment in SB 30.
Senator Boquist moves that Senate Bill 30 be amended with the dash one amendment. Discussion? Seeing none. Supported.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 30 as amended by the dash one to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves that Senate Bill 30, as amended, be sent to the Oregon State Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. We're going to go to the top of the list over here. Senator Riley, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to close that work session and open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 181. We have some people signed up here. No? All right. You want to give us an update, please, Kyle?
Oh, well.
This is part and parcel of the work group work.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Yeah, SB 181, we do have the -2 amendment, and that's what the paperwork is for as well, which I'll go through in just a second. But in the meeting materials under SB 181, I included just a list of what the -2 amendment changes are. The committee discussed this a couple weeks ago as changes that were prospective changes that might be included in there, and then there was some contact to some of the individuals or the individuals that did testify regarding the bill. So the changes that are included in there is one, there was a discussion of confidentiality. And just, I should back up. The Senate Bill 181 is discussing the information return of specified nonprofits that are receiving exemption under the Literary, Charitable, and Scientific Organizations exemption. So yeah, at the chart in OLIS goes through, one of the changes was removing the confidentiality. Much of the information, if not all the information that will be on the information return, is already public in one way, shape, or form. And there was concern about making it non-disclosable to the assessors, making them felons potentially. So the confidentiality portions were removed. There was also inclusions of some of the timing of required forms. The committee heard testimony on potential issues if there wasn't some grace period was the language used. So there's references to existing statute about filing a late return if needed or something to that effect and having a late fee if you need to. But there is some of that built in now. And then some of the smaller changes of just cleaning things up a little bit for Department of Revenue in regards to rulemaking authority and then removing this reference to a postcard, which was just seemed to be confusing individuals, even though it was trying to tie to some of the IRS, how they describe their extremely short return for the smaller nonprofits. So that's what you see up on the screen now is the changes there. So those have been included in the -2. We do have the revenue impact is a minimal. There's some expectation that by requiring these information returns, you could see a slight pickup of maybe a few accounts that no longer qualify. And that would be expected just because now that there's an annual filing of the return rather than a single filing initial upon application with no filing subsequently in later years. By requiring annual filing, you may pick up a few accounts that no longer qualify that would otherwise just continue to qualify because they only had to apply once. But so we could see a few of that. The fiscal is indeterminate, although it does list some of the cost potential to the county assessors, depending upon the workload and everything that they expend on each of these accounts. So there's an upward amount of possibly up to an hour and a half on some of these accounts is what the assessors have said. And part of that will be dependent upon how they're tracking information for later use. So there's no requirement in the bill for this information to be made, put together in a database or anything like that. But there is some, I guess, interest in doing so. Because it's going to be a new source of information. It'd certainly be interesting for the legislature to know about and the assessors as well. So that hits, I think, on the major changes in the -2.
If I remember from the hearing, the largest concern I remember was the confidentiality part, where it wasn't that people didn't mind. They just didn't know. It's hard to determine what is confidential and what isn't. And so that's been fixed. Any other questions to Kyle, Senator Riley?
Yeah. Wasn't there something about that we I thought we were putting in about the using the most recently available as opposed to the current year form?
Yes, Senator. Yeah, we did make that. That change did get included. So that way, yeah, there was some concern that being requiring this year's tax form, it wouldn't actually produce the 990 return. So now it'll be the most currently filed and timely filed, a requirement of that. So you will have to file on time with the IRS or the Department of Justice if it's your season.
And that is an amendment.
And that is in the changes, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do we have anybody from the county assessors here today to talk about this?
Yeah, he's in the back corner.
Yeah, he's sitting back there.
Polk County. The Polk County Assessor is here.
Basically, where he's coming, Kyle, a lot of these changes came from the assessors and everything, right?
The assessors, Department of Revenue made some technical one, and then the Nonprofit Association
made some requests,
also.
Yeah. We incorporate those.
Yeah.
Senator Riley, did you have a Or Senator Borchardt, did you have a question?
Yeah, just kind of, you know, what was your part in this last amendment?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, and what Kyle went over primarily were requests that we had. The confidentiality issue, that's been addressed. The timing issue, that's been addressed because it appeared that they were going to have to provide a 990 that wasn't available yet. So now it just says the most recently filed. So we did not have objections to the amendments because we thought it cleared the bill up. And again, our hope is that by the assessors gathering this information and compiling this information for hopefully legislative revenue, that the legislature will get some clear ideas of what charitable means and get some idea of maybe some qualification criteria that will help assessors identify which property should be a charitable and which one shouldn't.
Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair. Yeah,
okay.
That's great.
All right, thanks, Doug, for coming
in.
Okay,
thanks.
Anybody
else signed up?
No,
nobody signed up. Are you ready?
Yeah,
ready. Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment to SB 818, dated 3/6/17, into the main bill.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 181 be amended with the -2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 181 as amended by the -2 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves that Senate Bill 181 be moved to the floor of the Oregon State Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. Boquist and Riley, this is in your wheelhouse, and I know you're carrying the other bills, but would either one of you...
I'll
carry it.
He wants it.
Senator Boquist will carry.
So, no, do you carry the next one?
Yeah.
Right. And we'll close that work session, and I think we are good for the day. And we'll see you back here tomorrow at 8:30. We are adjourned. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 8:30.